His face was firm but gently sweet in its expression, and he was older than I. He had the look of an Italian I had seen a picture of on earth. He had that fine high look about his features which only genius lends to her petted favorites. He was like poetry. He put out his hand and smiled wondrously, but just as I put mine out and spoke to him, he suddenly was visible no more, and I could not see where he had gone. "Won't you come again?" I cried as I looked vacantly in the place where he stood. I could not understand it, but his visit had given me so much pleasure that I resolved to come to that same spot and see if he would not be there also. I seemed to feel that this man was a great person. Now I had come into the garden but three times more, and each time I had seen the wonderful stranger, who had conversed with me and taught me such great and glorious things that I almost felt sometimes I wanted to leave the little sheltered nook in which my aunt dwelt and seek a higher and a wider plane of life. These longings grew within me until a great desire came into my soul to seek a higher sphere of life. Was I then really to leave this beautiful spot and not stay to help enlarge and beautify it for the reception of my father and mother still on earth? This thought troubled me, and through it all my spirit was sore grieved. But as I absorbed the lessons I received from my frequent visitor, the handsome stranger, who now came so often, I had grown to feel that we always knew each other, though I did not yet know his name. A great peace settled within me and about me, and I was ready for whatever life might bestow upon me. One early day, in the full sweet morning light, I sat listening to a nightingale and such sweet music I had never heard. It seemed to me as the bird's song came out upon the air it was very much like a human voice that called loudly in sorrow, and moaned in tortured pain. My sympathies were aroused and I listened intently. The bird notes grew fainter and sweeter, then changed and rose into a wonderful joy melody, and slowly sweetly died away. This song of the nightingale somehow had told me of my discontent, my sadness at leaving, and of my sure change of abiding place. And when the wonderful music sighed itself into silence, I knew that I was going to leave Aunt Agatha and seek some other home, and I was at peace. Straightway I told her on entering the house of my revelation, and she laughed and patted my head, saying, "You are the most imaginative child I ever saw, Ovra. Now that I have just learned the joy of your presence, you think you are to leave me. No, child, I can't see you going yet, if ever." Soon after that, I know not how many hours or days, for time is eternity with us, I met with my frequent visitor, the Italian gentleman, for so I had found that he was. He told me so much of the sunshine and the flowers and picturesque scenery of his mother country on earth, and at this time he was saying to me, "Beautiful spirit, do you not know that there are other climes here than this one in which you dwell?" I answered yes, and he continued, "About some of these spheres I can tell you much, but you would be more benefited to see them." Whenever he spoke his voice was like a soft distant flute and his face was wreathed in smiles. "Yes, my friend," I said, "I want to see these wonderful places. For I have been visiting but little, and that was with my guiding spirit," and as I mentioned her name I saw a curious glad light of recognition leap into his eyes. "Do you know her?" I questioned. "Yes and no," he replied, trying, I thought, to avoid me. "I have heard much of her." He was looking straight into my soul with his deep dark eyes, and what he found there made me conscious of a like something that dwelt within the depths of his soul. And we two gazed and gazed. The knowledge that we gained in that rapt gazing was too deep, too sweet for normal utterance. While our eyes still held each other's, he vanished as usual from my sight. The knowledge of so mighty a sweetness filled me that I did not know my aunt was standing near until she touched me, smiling as I looked at her, a little sadly, I thought. "So, over a child, is this the nightingale's song?" "No. No, auntie," I faltered, this is why you are going to leave me," she replied with quiet gravity. "Each soul must in earth or heaven have a mate, and when that mate is centered and attracted no power can prevent it from finding its other half. There never was a soul that was complete in itself, my child, but finding its other self, it reaches at last, a whole within itself. Then the two selves, or twin souls, are ready to progress together. But auntie, I said, where is the man's soul then that belongs to you? I wanted that we talk of Aunt Agatha's future than mine just then. He is still on earth, child, and that is why I linger here, waiting, always waiting for him. My aunt was looking afar off when the last word fell from her lips, and her look caught and held my gaze. Somehow her face had grown all young and flushed, and a great sweet flood of light overspread her countenance. How long will you have to wait? I asked hopefully. Until his earth life is ended, she said, absently and simply, do you ever see him? I asked again, fondly thinking of my visits to my loved ones still on earth. I suppose I had been in the spirit world now some few months of earthly time, but which seemed of momentary passing in this fairy land of souls. My aunt looked full into my face and smiled a happy wistful smile. We always see those we love best when we wish to, dear child, she said quietly. Then she told me how when she and the man soul, her other part, were in the flush of their young girlhood and boyhood life, how very happy they had been, and that the months and years almost numbered the day of matrimony for them. Only a shadow passed between them and gradually grew and stretched into a gulf so wide and deep that neither of them in earth life could ever cross it, and so in dreary bitterness they had parted. She told me how he went away thousands of miles, and at last became a wanderer on the face of the earth. Slowly but how surely her grief had claimed her, until on hearing of his marriage, she died suddenly and awakened to sorrow in the first experience of her spirit life. She told me how she had toiled and wearily, sadly worked her way up to her present gradation in the spirit world. How that she could not be contented to try to live until she stole out into the world again and sought out the love of her youth, and in his presence learned her peace of heart. Then she had found her way into this spot, and with the aid of others had builded her little cottage here in which we dwelt. Sometime, she said, he will come to me, and then we will be happy together. He feels already that he will come to me, but he knows not how or where. He is not happy in life, but very miserable, and often he cries to his Maker to let him die, and be done with all. How little he knows of the life he will meet here, but my child, I am prepared to aid him and lift him up into the blessed kingdom of truth. I thought much of this and felt deep compassion for them, for her waiting here, for the lingering mortal of earth, and for him in the darkness of that lower life. I was learning speedier what life really means. I heard them as we conversed together, a mighty chorus of distinct voices above us, and looking up saw indistinctly a throng of floating spirits singing joyously as they sped along. Who are these, and where do they go? I asked Aunt Agatha. They are blessed messengers from the Band of Mercy on their way to the earth on missions, said my aunt, gently. Do you know on what kind of missions they are going? I asked my aunt, much interested. Yes, she answered quickly. The messengers for the Band of Mercy always go to those who are afflicted with bodily ills and help them so that they may gain health again, and if they cannot do that, they escort them into this world, this land of promise. There is a Band of Hope who go to those afflicted mentally and to those who are in any struggle, or terrible trouble, and see them safely through. How steadfastly I was thinking of how I wished had I known all this before I came to live in the spirit world, how much good it could have done. Even while I was in this silent and deep meditation, my aunt slipped away to attend the presence of one who had just called, and was waiting. She called me and said, this spirit who has just arrived has come for you, Ovra. I went instantly to where they were standing, and as I drew near I perceived that our visitor was a woman, clad in shining white garments and glittering with precious gems. She spoke almost instantly, saving, Ovra, your dear guiding spirit has kindly sent me to you, to tell you that she awaits you not far distant, where you are to go with me and join her. Make ready, bid your aunt farewell, and come. She spoke so gently, sweetly, and yet fully imperative that I felt ready to comply with her wishes at once. As I kissed my aunt goodbye, and took my leave with the messenger, I felt that I was going away not to return except that I might come back to visit Aunt Agatha sometime. I told her this on going, but she only smiled and waved her handkerchief, as we sped so hastily away. My escort conversed with me as we traveled along, and told me that she knew my guiding spirit well, and oftentimes went on errand missions for her. I was rejoiced at this, for I loved anyone who would do a kindly favor for my gracious guide. Soon I saw her standing a little distance ahead, smiling and beckoning us on. When we drew nearer, she came running toward me, and patting my cheek said, "You are a dutiful child, Ovra, to come so quickly when you are bidden. Did you like to come?" "Yes," I answered, simply. "Do you know where you are going?" she asked again. "No, I do not, neither do I care so long as you are leading me. I only know it is right for me to do as you bid me, and I am so happy in doing so that I cannot begin to express it." She bent very close to me and touched my forehead with her lips, and such a wondrous soft light crept into her beautiful face, that I could have wept for sheer joy. This was indeed to me an example of the love of duty. She spoke again. "Did you feel no pangs at leaving your aunt, my child?" "No, dear one," I replied, "yet I will never see her again, only as I may go to visit her or until she comes where I am going to go now." "My dear Ovra," she answered, "you are all that I would have you, but how did you know you were coming away to stay?" "The nightingale first told me in her happy, sad song," I said quietly. This seemed to please her, for she said, "That is very good, child, but I have yet to tell you what the nightingale left out. You are now going with me to meet your other part. You must now enter into a completeness of self that will prepare you and enable you to progress and unfold as you should do." "My other part, what is that?" I queried. "It is the mate of your soul, the man soul that belongs to you. Your aunt has spoken to you of this before." I did not look up at her, for now I understood the full meaning of her words, and I did not wish her to know the conflicting emotions that filled my soul. I had been so full of love and duty an instant before, and now just this condition had shaken my resolutions and my pleasure to atoms. I did not dare to speak to my guide of these wayward thoughts of mine, and as I only said, "If I am to meet the mate of my soul, where are we going for this meeting?" I raised my eyes to meet her full innocent gaze, as she replied, "To the land of heart's desire." I knew that in the one deep look her mind had touched my very depths and had read them my secret. I knew now that I did not want to go to the land of heart's desire, because I believed I was to meet a stranger that I would dislike. She saw in my heart another picture, of a handsome dark face, with the sunny eyes of Italy shining there. How I had tried to hide this face in the very depths of me, but the eyes of my guiding spirit were the seers of her soul, and could fathom deep. She was prone to test me further, so she said, "Ovra, do you still wish to go where I lead you? Are you content in your journey to the land of heart's desire?" "No, dear guide," I faltered, "I do not wish to go there if I am to meet a stranger, one that I have never known, for I could not feel that he was my soul's mate, no, never." "Where, then, would you rather go?" she asked quickly. "To my mother," I almost sobbed. "Surely not." She made answer, "For in the land of heart's desire lies all your future blessedness." I could not comprehend her speech, but I shut my eyes and prayed. I felt a strong and steadfast truth taking hold of me, and I felt suddenly at peace. All calmly then I put my hand in hers, and sending her young messenger ahead of us, we glided forward toward the land of heart's desire. The sweetest perfumes burdened the air, and loaded it with billows of varied and rich fragrance. As we came into the borders of this ideal country, I was amazed at the marvelous beauty of everything. The loveliest flowers, the purest, clearest waters, the grandest mountains and trees, with the happiest of women and children, the kindest fathers, and the bravest men. We did not stop to make inquiry of anyone as we passed, but floating over a tiny brook I caught a sight of my face, and I knew my looks did not belie my feelings. I was happy. Almost before I realized it, we stopped before a huge old pile of mansion, whose towered splendor was like the tales of old, where sweet flowers bordered the rustic walks, and birds sang sweetly to each other in the treetops all day long. As we entered, we perceived a pure crystal fountain, gushing up in the midst of crimson roses. My guiding spirit guided me safely up the massive steps to the mansion entrance, and there as we stood expectantly waiting, the great doors opened of themselves, and she, my good guide, led me down the long corridors, through the beautiful rooms, until at last we stood in what she told me was my chamber, the Chamber of Jasmines. Any place that I looked, I saw jasmines embedded within the walls and floor of this wonderful room. I started to pluck them, but I found them to be made within the materials themselves. I felt someone drawing near me, and as I turned, I saw the beloved form of the handsome stranger who was so close to my very soul. I looked intently at him, and he gently put out his arms and took my hands in his. "I am the terrible mate of your soul, my dearest Ofra," he said, smilingly, and I could not answer at once. I looked to speak to my guide, but she had gone somewhere I knew not. At last I found my voice. "I was afraid it would not be you," I said slowly, but he reassured me, "it could have been no one else. You were mine and I was yours from the beginning." "I knew it," I answered, happily. As we stood there, seemingly alone, I saw again the radiant face of my guide. "God bless my children," she was saying, as we made our vows, "Bury Caspello and I." Great and mighty strains of music filled the chambers of that old castle with holy sweetness. The heavens and their mighty bands of spirits proclaimed us one, and so we have gone on in our labors side by side, reaching up into progress as we go on and on. So it is that now I come to tell you, world of mortals, a little of my experience in the land of souls. The materialization of nature. William Denton. It has been a question in every mind, skeptic and believer alike, just how, or through what process the phase of materialization was produced. We can the better make you comprehend this special manifestation by first conveying to your mind the one and only law governing it. You see, each changing season of the year, the spring, the summer, the fall and the winter, each varying, and each so marvelously different, and still you do not count these occurrences anything past common. And it is not because you understand the inner laws and workings of nature better than you do spirit manifestation that you are not curious about them, but the reason is simply this: from the moment your baby eyes opened on the material world you saw these things, and through year on year of your lives in the earth sphere you have become so used to nature's untiring labors in furnishing, clothing and being to the world, that her great work is no longer a marvel to you, but the very commonest of happenings. You of the world are ever ready to ask the following question with untiring zeal: why does the materializing medium use a dark cabinet? The question is but natural, considering the common environments under which the mortals of today are existing. If you will tell us, reader, just why a seed must first be enveloped in the darkness of the earth before any visible life can sprout from it, then we will in turn answer: as all life must have a cause and likewise an origin, so the life of the vegetable kingdom must have a central activity from which to spring. This same central activity is the tiny seed that is placed so carefully in the breast of Mother Earth for her to hold and so magnetize and sensitize by her wonderfully refining powers, for the rain to fall upon and moisten, for the dews of heaven to come and visit, until the combination of such vivifying forces has so surrounded the tiny seeds that it has gradually taken on so much from their vibrations that life really begins to stir in its heart, and soon that life shows itself in a timid peeping above Mother Earth's bosom, and the warm air and sunshine gives to that new life such coloring as its forefathers were wont to bear. I have now to tell you that this process is distinctly the one through which materialization of spirit entities take place. Now that same cabinet that has caused so much cavil, holds within it deep darkness and vitalizing influences in great quantities, and stands in place of, and in the office of Mother Earth. The medium is the seed placed in the bosom of darkness as the central and principal cause of the new life that is to come. "Oh, but you say, the medium is alive and stirring, while the seed of a plant is apparently dead as to action." "All very well," we answer, "but the medium must become as the seed before the forces can draw around him and do their necessary work. This seemingly inanimate condition into which the medium is thrown is so much below normal activity that it is called by those who know it for what it is, the dead trance. That is that the sensibilities of this instrument become gradually so lulled that the physical action of the body is stilled and the body is in deep and insensible sleep, while the real ego, the self of that individual, departs from the body, and almost always is itself asleep elsewhere. When the medium is so placed, then it is that he needs the forces of light and moisture, such as the seed in the ground must have before it can send forth new life. But the circle mortals which form around his cabinet, must be to him what the light of heaven, the precious dews and the fall of rain are to the waiting seed. The magnetic aura is drawn from the seated circle invisibly, quietly, and by the great law of attraction and repulsion, this same aura is taken from mortals in little wave motions and made to so intermingle with the medium and his band of invisible helpers as to cause at last, an upspringing of new life in the form of the materialization of spirits. You do not see the spirit itself, but only its outward expression. So it is that when a tree or flower has passed through this same process of formation, you do not see the life of the flower itself, but you do see its outward expression. So now you will understand that the materialization of spirits and the materialization of nature are of one and the same principle in effect, and it remains to be seen that all the difference between them is that one is material and the other is ethereal. You say, yes, but a spirit form does not stay as a flower does, and we answer again that they remain exactly alike, for neither leaves until its strength is so spent that the law of nature comes back to her own and dematerializes both flower and spirit from our sight. There is no living thing in all your universe but what has first had its being through nature's materialization. And don't forget this one important fact, nothing has ever in all the history of time, come into the possession of life, but that a certain set of conditions was made before life was organized and born. Darkness must surround and enfold the life germ of anything before that germ can ever come into existence. The great rocks, the mighty mountains, the rivers, the cataracts and the finished wonders of nature's materialization have taken centuries upon centuries to complete. The sun, the water, the air are the circle that nature has selected to furnish the forces for the vibration for her great and constant labors of materialization, and your world in all its magnificent perfection of beauty is her result. She gathers her mediums and selects them from all the myriads of seeds that drop on her bosom, or are planted there by mortal hand. So our grandmother nature holds in her hand a gift of God. It is the years of building upon building, for the world of mortals to enjoy. It is the divine plan of the ages. The sublime truth of spiritualism. Wesley Abba, friends, how can anyone of reasoning faculties doubt the sublime truth of spiritualism and its wonderful manifestations? Phenomena have existed through all ages to the present epoch of this century, and yet you of the present day do not begin to comprehend the unerring rules and laws that will guide you in seeking after light and truth, and to the development of the forces in nature inherent in mankind, a knowledge of which is not gained in a day, week or month, but only after a strict observance of the laws and rules, and a careful study of them, also, earnestly and constantly following those sublime teachings. Through mediums you are enabled to understand the wonderful powers they possess. By continual study the dawn of light illuminates the darkness and you feel the presence of your spirit friends whose loving, watchful care admonishes you to follow the true path that leads to a higher sphere and a true knowledge of yourself, so that by continuing, you are enabled to see these refulgent rays of spiritual truth in all their purity. They draw around you a halo of light, love and happiness unknown to those who have not studied the simple rules which guide you through the doctrines of spiritualism until you receive ocular demonstrations of the immortality of the soul and are at length enabled to fully comprehend spirit manifestations in all their wonderful truths and beauty. But to acquire knowledge and obtain any branch of learning, you must study earnestly and constantly in order to have a full realization of the truth of spiritualism or any subject that lies beyond the realms of the physical senses. The mental action of the brain must be exalted to that grade of intensity which will correspond with the action of the elements in the organism. Hence the expression of advanced thought must require a brain of great degree of refinement and its action necessarily be intense while the thought is being projected upon it. This is why there is such a marked difference between the ideas of religious thinkers. Spiritualism is a religion of its own far beyond the conception of creed-bound mortals, and radiates to the world of mortals the principles which underlie all forms and grades of creative power, but it presents these as ever-living and everlasting factors. The mind must be fed on truth to be strong and symmetrical, and the nearer it can approach the truth in its purity, the more powerful these developments are in any line or department of spiritualism or science. There may be enthusiasm and devotion to error, and determination to uphold it as of equal importance with the truth, but the endeavor to preserve the error at all costs only results in crippling the reasoning power and holding the mind upon a plane where mental activity is paralyzed. But it is encouraging that never has there been such a general demand for this truth and the systems in nature, as at this period. Love is the most potent factor in spiritualism, being the active power in all life. Even the grass loves and draws to it the elements by which it grows, but that kind of love is selfish because it is limited to itself. Such is the nature of love devoid of knowledge. The religious zeal of ages has been the cause of more crimes, bloodshed and misery than any other one feature of man's nature. So with the religious devotees, and, in their struggles they have looked for the cause of their difficulty in everything but in themselves, and they being out of the divine, see everything like themselves as evil, and are ever ready to destroy it. This gives to man a base of everlastingness of the remedies and in the capacity of progress of which you are able to assign no light. Remember, dear brothers and sisters, there is a grander world than yours, there is a divine life, a more glorifying condition than that of the body. It is an utter impossibility for the real seeker after truth or scientific knowledge, willingly to oppose the hypothesis of spiritualism. This leads all to desire a knowledge of that which lies beyond the reach of your present earthly faculties, and the more you investigate this sublime subject, the more real is the scientific aspiration, more refined and devoted is the investigation with the testimony of so many witnesses, and the assurance given to every true spiritualist in the land comes to your aid in sympathy, and this helps you to acquire a consummation so grand and glorious. My life in the spirit world. Otto Butler. Dear ones, I was very young when first I entered this then strange country. I cannot now remember the early happenings of my life, but I know that I was growing steadily both in soul and body, and that I was able as time went on to observe the lessons that my great tutors were teaching me. I remember the home to which I came when I died, and that a white-robed messenger came with some of my relatives to fetch me there. The house was at the back of a green grassy plot, and here and there at different distances apart were great fountains playing and throwing their crystal waters up into the gleaming sunlight. A broad white walk was at the front, and on either side of this walk were deep beds of roses of all the varying shades of coloring that you can well imagine. The very air was full of their sweetness. When I grew a little away from wandering at the strange and entrancing beauty of the place, for even one who is very young will be amazed in entirely new surroundings, they took me for a full view of everything. On the right of the green velvet lawn lay a tiny pool with a crystal rock boundary and pebbled bottom, so that I could see very clearly the pebbles as I looked within. In the middle of this pool grew creamy white lilies, and their leaves floated as the air rustled among them. Off to the left lay a bed of purple violets, and these almost seemed to smile as I looked at them. As I grew and unfolded, I learned some new wonder, and I was never tired of asking how all these wonders came to be. I was always told that when I was old enough I should know all this. I can remember that I was always inquisitive and anxious to know so much that I could scarcely wait until I was sent to school. The schools here are different from your schools of earth in that they are instituted for the purpose of really educating the young. Those who come to be instructed are detained and gradually examined by spirits capable of such examination, and placed in the department of instruction that is most conducive to bring about the best and most rounded result to their particular organism. For instance, no one is subjected to any certain or unusual routine of education, but whatever is found to be best for him is given.